Halt! Nora screamed again. Halt right where you are! He was thinking it was a most incredibly lucky break. He was less than 60 yards from the holding cell where he intended to store Dan Keaton for safekeeping. As for the other fellow, well, that would depend on what the two of them had been up to, wouldn't it? They weren't exactly wearing the expressions of men who have been ministering to the sick and comforting the grief-stricken. Trooper Price looked from Norris to the men standing by the old-fashioned board sign, which read, Castle County Courthouse. Then he looked back at Norris again. Ace and Zippy's dad looked at each other. Then both of them eased their hands downward toward the butts of the guns, which protruded over the waistbands of their pants. Norris had pointed the barrel of his revolver skyward, as he had been taught to do in situations like this. Now, still following procedure, he clasped his right wrist in his left fist and leveled the revolver. If the books were right, they would not realize that the muzzle was pointed directly between them. Each would believe Norris was aiming at him. Move your hands away from your weapons, my friends. Do it now. Buster and his companion exchanged another glance and dropped their hands to their sides. Norris snapped a look at the trooper. You, he said. Price, want to give me a little help here, if you're not too tired, that is? What are you doing? Price asked. He sounded worried and unwilling to pitch in. The night's activities, with the hammering demolition of the bridge to cap them, had reduced him to bystander status. He apparently felt uncomfortable about stepping back into a more active role. Things had gotten too big, too fast. Arresting these two boogers, Norris snapped. What in the hell does it look like? Arrest this fellow, Ace said, and flipped Norris the bird. Buster uttered a high, yodeling laugh. Price looked at them nervously and then returned his troubled gaze to Norris. On what charge? Buster's friend laughed. Norris directed his full attention back to the two men and was alarmed to see their positions relative to each other had changed. When he had thrown down on them, they had been almost shoulder to shoulder. Now they were almost 5 feet apart and still sidling. Stand still, he bawled. They stopped and exchanged another glance. Move back together. They only stood there in the pouring rain, hands dangling, looking at him. I'm arresting them on an illegal weapons charge to start with, Norris yelled furiously to Trooper Joe Price. Now get your thumb out of your butt and give me a help. This shocked Price into action. He tried to take his own revolver out of its holster, discovered the safety strap was still on, and began fumbling with it. He was still fumbling when the barbershop and the funeral home blew up. Buster, Norris, and Trooper Price all looked upstreet. Ace did not. He had been waiting for just this golden moment. He pulled the automatic from his belt with the speed of a Western quick-draw artist and fired. The bullet took Norris high in the left shoulder, clipping his lung and smashing his collarbone. Norris had taken a step away from the brick wall when he noticed the two men drifting apart. Now he was driven back against it. Ace fired again, chipping a crater in the brick an inch from Norris's ear. The ricochet made a sound like a very large, very angry insect. Oh, Christ! Trooper Price screamed, and began to labor more enthusiastically to free the safety strap over the butt of his gun. Burn that guy, Dad! Ace yelled. He was grinning. He fired at Norris again, and this third bullet tore a hot groove in the skinny deputy's left side as he collapsed to his knees. Lightning flashed overhead. Incredibly, Norris could still hear brick and wood from the latest explosions rattling down on the street. Trooper Price, at long last, managed to unsnap the strap over his gun. He was pulling it free when a bullet from the automatic Keaton held took his head off from the eyebrows on up. Price was hammered out of his boots and thrown against the brick wall of the alley. Norris raised his own gun once more. It seemed to weigh 100 pounds. Still holding it in both hands, he aimed at Keaton. Buster was a clearer target than his friend. More important, Buster had just killed a cop, and that shit most definitely did not go down in Castle Rock. They were hicks, maybe, but not barbarians. Norris pulled the trigger at the same moment Ace tried to shoot him again. The recoil of his revolver sent Norris flying backward. Ace's bullet buzzed through empty air where his head had been half a second before. Buster Keaton also went flying backward, hands clasped to his belly. Blood poured through his fingers. Norris lay against the brick wall near Trooper Price, panting harshly, one hand pressed against his wounded shoulder. Christ, this has been a really lousy day, he thought. Ace leveled the automatic at him, then thought better of it, at least for the time being. He went to Buster instead and dropped on one knee beside him. North of them, the bank went up in a roar of fire and pulverized granite. Ace didn't even look in that direction. He moved old Dad's hands to get a better look at the wound. He was sorry this had happened. He had been getting to like old Dad pretty well. Buster screamed, "Oh, it hurts! Oh, it hurts!" Ace just bet it did. Old Dad had taken a .45 slug just above his belly button. The entrance hole was the size of a head bolt. Ace didn't have to roll him over to know the exit hole would be the size of a coffee cup, probably with chunks of old Dad's spine sticking out of it like bloody candy canes. "It hurts! Hurts!" Buster screamed up into the rain. "Yeah." Ace put the muzzle of the automatic against Buster's temple. "Tough luck, Dad. I'm going to give you some painkiller." He pulled the trigger 3 times. Buster's body jumped and was still. Ace got to his feet, meaning to finish the goddamn deputy, if there was anything left to finish, when a gun roared and a bullet whined through the windy air less than a foot over his head. Ace looked up and saw another cop standing just outside the sheriff's office door to the parking lot. This one looked older than God. He was shooting at Ace with one hand while the other pressed against his chest above his heart. Seat Thomas's second try plowed into the earth right next to Ace, splashing muddy water on the toes of his engineer boots. The old buzzard couldn't shoot for shit, but Ace suddenly realized he had to get the hell out of here anyway. They had put enough dynamite in the courthouse to blow the whole building sky high. They had set the timer for 5 minutes, and here he was, all but leaning against it while fucking Methuselah took pot shots at him. Let the dynamite take care of both of them. It was time to go see Mr. Gaunt. Ace got up and ran into the street. The old deputy fired again, but this one wasn't even close. Ace ran behind the yellow news van, but made no attempt to get into it. The Chevrolet Celebrity was parked at Needful Things. It would do excellently as a getaway car. But first, he intended to find Mr. Gaunt and get paid off. Surely he had something coming, and surely Mr. Gaunt would give it to him. Also, he had a certain thieving sheriff to find. "Payback's a bitch," Ace muttered, and ran up Main Street toward Needful Things. Frank Jewett was standing on the courthouse steps when he finally saw the man he had been looking for. Frank had been there for some time now, and none of the things going on in Castle Rock tonight had meant much to him. Not the screams and shouts from the direction of Castle Hill, not Danforth Keaton and some elderly Hell's Angel running down the courthouse steps about 5 minutes ago, not the explosions, not the most recent rattle of gunshots, this time from right around the corner in the parking lot next to the sheriff's office. Frank had other fish to fry and other lemons to squeeze. Frank had a personal APB out on his excellent old friend, George T. Nelson. And boy, howdy, at last, there was George T. Nelson himself, in the flesh, strolling by on the sidewalk below the courthouse steps. Except for the automatic pistol jammed into the waistband of George T. Nelson's Sansa Belt polyester slacks and the fact that it was still raining like hell, the man might have been on his way to a picnic. Just strolling along in the rain was Monsieur George T. Motherfucking Nelson, just breezing along with the Christing breeze. And what had the note in Frank's office said? Oh, yes. "Remember, $2,000 at my house by 7:15 at the latest, or you will wish you were born without a dick." Frank glanced at his watch, saw it was closer to 8 o'clock than to 7:15, and decided that didn't matter much. He raised George T. Nelson's Spanish llama and pointed it at the head of the son-of-a-bitching shop teacher who had caused all his trouble. "Nelson!" he screamed. "George Nelson! Turn around and look at me, you prick!" George T. Nelson wheeled around. His hand dropped toward the butt of his automatic, then fell away when he saw he was covered. He placed his hands on his hips instead and peered up the courthouse steps at Frank Jewett, who stood there with rain dripping from his nose, his chin, and the muzzle of his stolen gun. "You going to shoot me?" George T. Nelson asked. "You bet I am," Frank snarled. "Just shoot me down like a dog, huh? Why not? It's what you deserve." To Frank's amazement, George T. Nelson was smiling and nodding. "A-up," he said, "and that's what I'd expect from a chicken shit bastard who'd break into a friend's house and kill a defenseless little birdie. Exactly what I'd expect. So go ahead, you yellow belly four eyes fuck. Shoot me and get it over with." Thunder bellowed overhead, but Frank didn't hear it. The bank blew up 10 seconds later, and he barely heard that. He was too busy struggling with his fury and his amazement. Amazement at the gall, the bold, bare-ass gall of Monsieur George T. Motherfucker Nelson. At last, Frank managed to break the lock on his tongue. Killed your bird. Right. Shit on that stupid picture of your mom. Right again. And what did you do? What did you do, George, besides make sure that I'll lose my job and never teach again? God, I'll be lucky not to end up in jail. He saw the total injustice of this in a sudden black flash of comprehension. It was like rubbing vinegar into a raw scrape. Why didn't you just come and ask me for money if you needed it? Why didn't you just come and ask? We could have worked something out, you dumb bastard. I don't know what you're talking about, George T. Nelson shouted back. All I know is that you're brave enough to kill teeny tiny parakeets, but you don't have balls enough to take me on in a fair fight. Don't know what? Don't know what I'm talking about, Frank sputtered. The muzzle of the llama wavered wildly back and forth. He could not believe the gall of the man below him on the sidewalk. Simply could not believe it. To be standing there with one foot on the pavement and the other practically in eternity, and to simply go on lying. No, I don't. Not the slightest idea. In the extremity of his rage, Frank Jewett regressed to the childhood response to such outrageous, bald-faced denial. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Coward, George T. Nelson smartly returned. Baby coward, parakeet killer, blackmailer, loony. Put the gun away, loony. Fight me fair. Frank grinned down at him. Fair? Fight you fair? What do you know about fair? George T. Nelson held up his empty hands and waggled the fingers at Frank. More than you, it looks like. Frank opened his mouth to reply, but nothing came out. He was temporarily silenced by George T. Nelson's empty hands. Go on, George T. Nelson said. Put it away. Let's do it like they do in the Westerns, George. If you've got the sack for it, that is. Fastest man wins. Frank thought, well, why not? Just why the hell not? He hadn't much else to live for, one way or the other, and if he did nothing else, he could show his old friend he wasn't a coward. Okay, he said, and shoved the llama into the waistband of his own pants. He held his hands out in front of him, hovering just above the butt of the gun. How do you want to do it, Georgie Porgy? George T. Nelson was grinning. You start down the steps, he said. I start up. Next time the thunder goes overhead... All right, Frank said. Fine. Let's do it. He started down the stairs, and George T. Nelson started up. Polly had just spotted the green awning of Needful Things up ahead when the funeral parlor and the barber shop went up. The glare of light and the roar of sound were enormous. She saw debris burst out of the heart of the explosion like asteroids in a science fiction movie and ducked instinctively. It was well that she did. Several chunks of wood and the stainless steel lever from the side of chair number 2, Henry Gendron's chair, smashed through the windshield of her Toyota. The lever made a weird, hungry humming sound as it flew through the car and exited by way of the rear window. Broken glass whispered through the air in a widening shotgun cloud. The Toyota, with no driver to steer it, bumped up over the curb, struck a fire hydrant, and stalled. Polly sat up, blinking, and stared out through the hole in the windshield. She saw someone coming out of Needful Things and heading toward one of the 3 cars parked in front of the store. In the bright light of the fire across the street, she recognized Alan easily. Alan! She yelled it, but Alan didn't turn. He moved with single-minded purpose, like a robot. Polly shoved open the door of her car and ran toward him, screaming his name over and over. From down the street came the rapid rattle of gunfire. Alan did not turn in that direction, nor did he look at the conflagration which, only moments ago, had been the funeral parlor and the barber shop. He seemed to be locked entirely on his own interior course of action, and Polly suddenly realized that she was too late. Leland Gaunt had gotten to him. He had bought something after all, and if she didn't make it to his car before he embarked on whatever wild goose chase it was that Gaunt was sending him on, he would simply leave. And God only knew what might happen then. She ran faster. Help me, Norris said to Seaton Thomas, and slung an arm around Seat's neck. He staggered to his feet. I think I winged him, Seaton said. He was puffing, but his color had come back. Good, Norris said. His shoulder hurt like fire, and the pain seemed to be sinking deeper into his flesh all the time, as if seeking his heart. "Now, just help me." "You'll be all right," Seaton said. In his distress over Norris, Seat had forgotten his fear that he was, in his words, coming down with a heart attack. "Soon's I get you inside..." "No," Norris gasped. "Cruiser."
"What?"
Norris turned his head and glared at Thomas with frantic, pain-filled eyes. "Get me in my cruiser. I have to go to Needful Things." Yes. The moment the words were out of his mouth, everything seemed to fall into place. Needful Things was where he had bought the Basin fishing rod. It was the direction in which the man who had shot him had gone running. Needful Things was the place where everything had started. Needful Things was where it all must end. Galaxia blew up, flooding Main Street with fresh glare. A double dragon machine rose out of the ruins, turned over twice, and landed upside down in the street with a crunch.
"Norris, you've been shot!"
"Of course I've been shot!"
Norris screamed. Bloody froth flew from his lips.
"Now, get me in the cruiser!"
"It's a bad idea, Norris."
"No, it's not,"
Norris said grimly. He turned his head and spat blood. "It's the only idea. Now, come on. Help me." Seat Thomas began to walk him toward Unit 2. If Alan hadn't glanced into his rearview mirror before backing out into the street, he would have run Polly down, completing the evening by crushing the woman he loved under the rear wheels of his old station wagon. He did not recognize her. She was only a shape behind his car, a woman shape outlined against the cauldron of flames on the other side of the street. He jammed on the brakes, and a moment later she was hammering at his window. Ignoring her, Alan began to back up again. He had no time for the town's problems tonight. He had his own. Let them slaughter each other like stupid animals if that was what they wanted to do. He was going to Mechanic Falls. He was going to get the man who had killed his wife and son in revenge for a piddling 4 years in the shank. Polly grabbed his door handle and was half-pulled, half-dragged out into the debris-strewn street. She punched down on the button below the handle, her hand shrieking with pain, and the door flew open with her clinging desperately to it and her feet dragging as Alan made his reverse turn. The nose of the station wagon was pointing down Main Street. In his grief and fury, Alan had totally forgotten that there was no bridge to cross down that way anymore.
"Alan!" she screamed. "Alan, stop!"
It got through. Somehow it got through in spite of the rain, the thunder, the wind, and the heavy, hungry crackle of the fire, in spite of his compulsion. He looked at her, and Polly's heart broke at the expression in his eyes. Alan wore the look of a man floating in the gut of a nightmare. "Polly?" he asked distantly.
"Alan, you have to stop!"
She wanted to let go of the door handle. Her hands were agony, but she was afraid that if she did, he would simply drive away and leave her there in the middle of Main Street. No, she knew he would. "Polly, I have to go. I'm sorry you're mad at me, that you think I did something, but we'll sort it out. Only I have to go."
"I'm not mad at you anymore, Alan. I know it wasn't you. It was him, playing us off against each other, like he has just about everyone else in Castle Rock, because that's what he does. Do you understand, Alan? Are you hearing me? Because that is what he does. Now stop. Turn off the goddamned engine and listen to me."
"I have to go, Polly," he said. His own voice seemed to be coming to him from far away, on the radio, perhaps. "But I'll be back."
"No, you won't," she cried.
Suddenly, she was furious with him, furious at all of them, all the greedy, frightened, angry, acquisitive people in this town, herself included.
"No, you won't, because if you leave now, there won't be a goddamn thing to come back to."
The video game parlor blew up. Debris stormed around Alan's car, parked in the middle of Main Street. Alan's talented right hand stole over, picked up the Tasty Munch can as if for comfort, and held it on his lap. Polly took no notice of the explosion. She stared at Alan with her dark, pain-filled eyes. "Polly,
look!"
she shouted suddenly and tore open the front of her blouse. Rainwater struck the swells of her breasts and gleamed in the hollow of her throat.
"Look, I took it off. The charm, it's gone. Now take yours off, Alan. If you're a man, take yours off."
He was having trouble understanding her from the depths of whatever nightmare it was which held him, the nightmare Mr. Gaunt had spun around him like a poisonous cocoon. And in a sudden flash of insight, she understood what that nightmare was, what it must be. "Did he tell you what happened to Annie and Todd?" she asked softly. His head rocked back as if she had slapped him, and Polly knew she had hit the mark. "Of course he did. What's the one thing in all the world, the one useless thing that you want so badly that you get it mixed up with needing it? That's your charm, Alan. That's what he put around your neck." She let go of the door handle and thrust both of her arms into the car. The glow from the dome light fell on them. The flesh was a dark, liverish red. Her arms were so badly swollen that her elbows were becoming puffy dimples. "There was a spider inside of mine," she said softly. "Hinky pinky spider, crawling up the spout. Down came the rain and washed the spider out. Just a little spider, but it grew. It ate my pain, and it grew. This is what it did before I killed it and took my pain back. I wanted so badly for the pain to be gone, Alan. That was what I wanted, but I don't need it to be gone. I can love you, and I can love life, and bear the pain all at the same time. I think the pain might even make the rest better, the way a good setting can make a diamond look better. Polly, of course, it has poisoned me," she continued thoughtfully, "and I think the poison may kill me if something isn't done. But why not? It's fair, hard, but fair. I bought the poison when I bought the charm. He has sold a lot of charms in his nasty little shop this last week. The bastard works fast, I'll give him that much. Hinky pinky spider crawling up the spout. That's what was in mine. What's inside yours? Annie and Todd, isn't it? Isn't it? Polly, Ace Merrill killed my wife. He killed Todd. He..." "No!" she screamed and seized his face in her throbbing hands. "Listen to me. Understand me. Alan, it's not just your life. Can't you see? He makes you buy back your own sickness, and he makes you pay double. Don't you understand that yet? Don't you get it?" He stared at her, mouth agape, and then, slowly, his mouth closed. A sudden look of puzzled surprise settled on his face. "Wait," he said. "Something was wrong. Something was wrong in the tape he left me. I can't quite..." "You can, Alan. Whatever the bastard sold you, it was wrong. Just like the name on the letter he left me was wrong." He was really hearing her for the first time. "What letter?" "It's not important now. If there's a later, I'll tell you then. The point is, he oversteps. I think he always oversteps. He's so stuffed with pride, it's a wonder he doesn't explode. Alan, please try to understand. Annie is dead. Todd is dead, and if you go out chasing Ace Merrill while the town is burning down around your ears..." A hand appeared over Polly's shoulder. A forearm encircled her neck and jerked her roughly backward. Suddenly, Ace Merrill was standing behind her, holding her, pointing a gun at her, and grinning over her shoulder at Alan. "Speak of the devil, lady," Ace said, and overhead, thunder cracked across the sky. Frank Jewett and his good old friend, George T. Nelson, had been facing each other on the courthouse steps like a pair of strange, bespectacled gunslingers for almost 4 minutes now, their nerves twanging like violin strings tuned to the ultimate octave. "Yig!" said Frank, his hand grabbed for the automatic pistol stuck in the waistband of his pants. "Ock!" said George T. Nelson, and grabbed for his own. They drew with identical feverish grins, grins that looked like big soundless screams, and threw down. Their fingers pressed the triggers. The two reports overlapped so perfectly that they sounded like one. Lightning flashed as the two bullets flew and nicked each other in mid-flight, deflecting just enough to miss what should have been a pair of point-blank targets. Frank Jewett felt a puff of air beside his left temple. George T. Nelson felt a sting on the right side of his neck. They stared at each other unbelievingly over the smoking guns. "Huh?" said George T. Nelson. "Hua?" said Frank Jewett. They began to grin identical, unbelieving grins. George T. Nelson took a hesitant step up toward Frank. Frank took a hesitant step down toward George. In another moment or two, they might have been embracing, their quarrel dwarfed by those two small puffs of eternity. But then the municipal building blew up with a roar that seemed to split the world in two, vaporizing them both where they stood. That final explosion dwarfed all the others. Ace and Buster had planted 40 sticks of dynamite in two clusters of 20 at the municipal building. One of these bombs had been left sitting on the judge's chair in the courtroom. Buster had insisted that they place the other on Amanda Williams's desk in the selectman's wing. "Women have no business in politics anyway," Buster explained to Ace. The sound of the explosion was shattering, and for a moment every window of the town's biggest building was filled with supernatural violet-orange light. Then the fire lashed out through the windows, through the doors, through the vents and grills, like merciless muscular arms. The slate roof lifted off intact like some strange gabled spaceship, rose on a cushion of fire, then shattered into 100,000 jagged fragments. In the next instant, the building itself blew outward in every direction, turning Lower Main Street into a hail of brick and glass where no living thing bigger than a cockroach could survive. 19 men and women were killed in the blast, 5 of them newspeople who had come to cover the escalating weirdness in Castle Rock and had become part of the story instead. State police cars and news vehicles were thrown end over end through the air like corgi toys. The yellow van which Mr. Gaunt had provided Ace and Buster cruised serenely up Main Street 9 feet above the ground, wheels spinning, rear doors hanging by their mangled hinges, tools and timers spilling out the back. It banked to the left on a hot hurricane thermal and crash-landed in the front office of the Dosti Insurance Agency, snow-plowing typewriters and file cabinets before its mangled grill. A shudder like an earthquake blundered through the ground. Windows shattered all over town. Weather vanes, which had been pointing steadily northeast in the prevailing wind of the thunderstorm, which was now beginning to abate as if embarrassed by the entrance of this avatar, began to whirl crazily. Several flew right off their spindles, and the next day one would be found buried deeply in the door of the Baptist church, like a marauding Indian's arrow. On Castle Avenue, where the tide of battle was turning decisively in favor of the Catholics, the fighting stopped. Henry Peyton stood by his cruiser, his drawn gun dangling by his right knee, and stared toward the fireball in the south. Blood trickled down his cheeks like tears. Reverend William Rose sat up, saw the monstrous glow on the horizon, and began to suspect that the end of the world had come, and that what he was looking at was Star Wormwood. Father John Brigham wandered down to him in drunken loops and staggers. His nose was bent severely to the left, and his mouth was a mass of blood. He considered punting Reverend Rose's head like a football and helped him to his feet instead. On Castle View, Andy Clutterbuck did not even look up. He sat on the front step of the Potter House, weeping and cradling his dead wife in his arms. He was still 2 years from the drunken plunge through the ice of Castle Lake, which would kill him, but he was at the end of the last sober day of his life. On Dell's Lane, Sally Ratcliffe was in her bedroom closet with a small, squirming conga line of insects descending the side seam of her dress. She had heard what had happened to Lester, understood that she had somehow been to blame, or believed she understood, and in the end it came to the same thing, and had hanged herself with the tie of her terry cloth bathrobe. One of her hands was thrust deep into the pocket of her dress. Clasped in this hand was a splinter of wood. It was black with age and spongy with rot. The woodlice with which it had been infested were leaving in search of a new and more stable home. They reached the hem of Sally's dress and began marching down one dangling leg toward the floor. Bricks whistled through the air, turning the building some distance away from ground zero into what looked like the aftermath of an artillery barrage. Those closer looked like cheese graters, or collapsed entirely. The night roared like a lion with a poisoned spear caught in its throat. Seat Thomas, who was driving the cruiser Norris Ridgwick insisted they take, felt the car's rear end rise gently, as if lifted by a giant's hand. A moment later, a storm of bricks engulfed the car. 2 or 3 punched through the trunk. One bonked on the roof. Another landed on the hood in a spray of brick dust the color of old blood and slithered off the front. "Jeez'em, Norris, the whole town's blowing up," Seat cried shrilly. "Just drive," Norris said. He felt as if he were burning up. Sweat stood out on his rosy, flushed face in big drops. He suspected that Ace had not wounded him mortally, that he had only winged him both times, but there was still something dreadfully wrong. He could feel sickness worming its way into his flesh, and his vision kept wanting to waver. He held grimly onto consciousness. As his fever grew, he became more and more certain that Alan needed him, and that if he was very lucky and very brave, he might yet be able to expiate the terrible wrong he had set in motion by slashing Hugh's tires. Ahead of him, he saw a small group of figures in the street near the green awning of Needful Things. The column of fire towering out of the ruins of the municipal building lit the figures in tableau like actors on a stage. He could see Alan's station wagon and Alan himself getting out of it. Facing him, his back turned to the cruiser in which Norris Ridgwick and Seaton Thomas were approaching, was a man with a gun. He was holding a woman in front of him like a shield. Norris couldn't see enough of the woman to make out who she was, but the man who was holding her hostage was wearing the tattered remains of a Harley-Davidson T-shirt. He was the man who had tried to kill Norris at the municipal building, the man who had blown Buster Keaton's brains out. Although he'd never met him, Norris was pretty sure he'd run afoul of town bad boy Ace Merrill.
"Jesus, Crow, Norris, that's Alan. What's going on now?"
"Whoever the guy is, he can't hear us coming," Norris thought. "Not with all the other noise. If Alan doesn't look this way, doesn't tip the shitbag off." Norris's service revolver was lying in his lap. He unrolled the passenger side window of the cruiser and then raised the gun. Had it weighed 100 pounds before? It weighed at least twice that now. "Drive slow, Seat. Slow as you can. And when I tap you with my foot, stop the car. Right away. Don't bother to think things over."
"With your foot? What do you mean, with your foot?"
"Shut up, Seat," Norris said with weary kindness. "Just remember what I said." Norris turned sideways, stuck his head and shoulders out of the window, and clutched the bar which held the cruiser's roof flashers. Slowly, laboriously, he pulled himself up and out until he was sitting in the window. His shoulder howled with agony, and fresh blood began to soak his shirt. Now they were less than 30 yards from the three people standing in the street, and he could aim directly along the roof at the man holding the woman. He couldn't shoot, at least not yet, because he would be likely to hit her as well as him. But if either of them moved, it was as close as Norris dared go. He tapped Seat's leg with his foot. Seat brought the cruiser to a gentle halt in the brick and rubble-littered street. "Move," Norris prayed. "One of you, please move. I don't care which one, and it only has to be a little. But please, please move." He did not notice the door of Needful Things open. His concentration was too fiercely focused on the man with the gun and the hostage. Nor did he see Mr. Leland Gaunt walk out of his shop and stand beneath the green awning.
"That money was mine, you bastard," Ace shouted at Alan. "And if you want this bitch back with all her original equipment, you better tell me what the hell you did with it."
Alan had stepped out of the station wagon.
"Ace, I don't know what you're talking about."
"Wrong answer,"
Ace screamed. "You know exactly what I'm talking about. Pop's money, in the cans. If you want the bitch, tell me what you did with it. This offer is good for a limited time only, you cocksucker."
From the tail of his eye, Alan caught movement from below them on Main Street. It was a cruiser, and he thought it was a county unit, but he did not dare take a closer look. If Ace knew he was being blindsided, he would take Polly's life. He would do it in less time than it took to blink. So instead, he fixed his sightline upon her face. Her dark eyes were weary and filled with pain, but they were not afraid. Alan felt sanity begin to fill him again. It was funny stuff, sanity. When it was taken away, you didn't know it. You didn't feel its departure. You only really knew it when it was restored, like some rare wild bird which lived and sang within you, not by decree, but by choice. "He got it wrong," he said quietly to Polly. "Gaunt got it wrong on the tape."
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
Ace's voice was jagged, coked up. He dug the muzzle of the automatic into Polly's temple. Of all of them, only Alan saw the door of Needful Things open stealthily. And he would not have seen it if he had not directed his gaze so stringently away from the cruiser which was creeping up the street. Only Alan saw, ghostly, at the very edge of vision, the tall figure that came out, a figure dressed not in a sport coat or a smoking jacket, but in a black broadcloth coat, a traveling coat. In one hand, Mr. Gaunt held an old-fashioned valise, the sort in which a drummer or traveling salesman might have carried his goods and samples in days of old. It was made of hyena hide, and it was not still. It puffed and bulged below the long white fingers which gripped its handle. And from inside, like the sound of a distant wind or the ghostly cry one hears in high-tension wires, came the faint sound of screams. Alan did not hear this horrid and unsettling sound with his ears. He seemed to hear it with his heart and in his mind. Gaunt stood beneath the canopy, where he could see both the approaching cruiser and the tableau by the station wagon, and in his eyes there was an expression of dawning irritation, perhaps even concern. Alan thought, "And he doesn't know that I've seen him. I'm almost sure of that. Please, God, let me be right."